This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we'll have a family law discussion of guardianships for minor children. My guest is Deborah Wald, a specialist in family law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and her law firm is the Wald Law Group in San Francisco. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Deborah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
It's been too many years since you were here, and so it's good to have you back. Your practice in family law is apparently exclusively involving children.
That's correct. So my law firm does lots of things, but in terms of my own focus, I focus almost exclusively on issues involving children.
Now, when I was planning this program, B.J. Fadham, who is my contact with and a member of the executive committee of the Family Law Section, said you wanted to do a program on guardianship for minor children.
I did.
And why?
Because, honestly, I think that guardianships are a wonderful tool that are not well enough known about or understood. And could really serve a lot of families well if there was more information available about them. And there aren't a lot of attorneys who do guardianships. There isn't a lot of information out there about them. And so I was hoping maybe we could talk about them for a while.
I think
and get
that's
some of
very
that
important.
Out.
What's the difference between a guardianship and let's say, a foster care?
So the way I describe it is that guardianship is the private alternative to foster care. So if a child needs care because the parents are unable to care for that child, the public solution to that is foster care. But if there are friends, neighbors, family members who recognize that a child needs care and are able to provide that care, they can keep that child out of foster care by applying for a guardianship.
Is there, just to make sure of this, is this a guardianship, in your opinion, with all of your practice, more favorable for a child as opposed to foster care or?
Yes. I mean, my short answer would be yes, because, I mean, I'm not in any way, shape, or form meaning to attack foster care, but our foster care system is terribly overburdened. Mm-hmm. There are way more children. I mean, foster care is designed really for emergencies. Where there is no good alternative, mm-hmm. and it is terribly overburdened, lots of people doing their best, but there aren't enough good foster homes, and, you know, it's problematic. Mm-hmm. It's a big bureaucracy, mistakes get made, and fundamentally, in foster care, kids, for the most part, are being placed with strangers. If you can find someone they already know who's willing to step up, you know, that's a lovely alternative for everyone involved. And it takes the burden off of our public system, so our public system mm-hmm. can focus on folks who really need, you know, the kids who have nowhere else to go.
What's the difference between a guardianship, for example, and someone going who wants to adopt a child?
So when you adopt a child, the parental rights of that child's original parents are terminated.
And that's the adoptive, that's it. Essentially strangers
so,
at that point.
Well, so in California, we do have a system for what are called post-adoption contact agreements. Mm-hmm. So, and those create what we call open adoptions. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the experience of the child, it doesn't have to be a complete cutoff. It may be, it can be, but it doesn't have to be. But legally, mm-hmm. all of the rights and duties of parent shift from the original parents to the adoptive parents. The responsibility to support the child, the right to make all the decisions, all of that goes to the adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. So the old parents, and actually typically the kid gets a new birth certificate with the adoptive parents' names on it instead of the original parents.
Really?
So it's a full transfer of parental rights. Guardianship does not terminate the parental rights of the parents. Mm-hmm. What it does is shift custody. Mm-hmm. So the parents are still the parents, but somebody else has custody of the child.
What about going to school or doing medical care and this kind of thing? When there's a guardianship, what role do the parents have with respect to whether that child goes to this school or that school, or gets medical care from this doctor or that doctor, generally speaking?
So generally speaking, again, once a formal legal guardianship is in place, mm-hmm. the parents have lost custody to the guardian or have voluntarily transferred custody to the guardian. So then the guardian has the legal right to deal with all the health, education, and welfare issues, mm-hmm. get medical care, enroll the child in school, make the important decisions.
What about the support of the child? Do the parents have any, if a parent is healthy or has a job or whatever, is the parent still responsible for the support of the child if the parent has any money?
Sure, yeah. No, there is some continuing responsibility, financial responsibility. As long as that person remains a parent, there is mm-hmm. some continuing financial responsibility for mm-hmm. the child. Although, when I think about it, the guardianships I've been involved in, I don't think that I've been involved in one where the parent was capable of supporting the child.
So generally they're not, at least in your experience.
Right. So children who need a guardian, typically it's because they do not currently have a parent who is fit and able to take care of them themselves.
In your practice, and you've been doing this, you've been doing exclusively a practice for children for, what, a couple of decades or so?
Yeah. About that, about 20 years.
You look a lot younger.
Thank you.
Is this something that, for example, if for example, we have a parent who is terminally ill, that would be a basis upon which perhaps you might have a guardian?
Yeah, so typical situations where we look to guardianships are a parent is ill, a parent is suffering from mental illness, a parent is has a substance abuse issue, a parent has to leave a deployed parent in the military might
yes.
be in a position to need to appoint a guardian. One of the common misunderstandings about guardianship is people think, I'll hear, oh yeah, and I'm the guardian because they wrote a letter saying, you know, I'm granting you guardianship of
yeah.
my child.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a formal court guardianship.
And in California, as I understand from what you told me, this is in the probate court.
That's correct.
Not the family law court.
That's correct.
And why is that?
I mean, here you are, you're
a family law certified specialist. Why is this in the probate court and not the family law court?
So conservatorships, which are sort of the equivalent but for older and incapacitated adults,
mm-hmm.
are handled in the probate along with estates and trusts. And somehow guardianships and conservatorships have been kept together.
I see.
And so that's where they are. They're in the probate court. It actually sometimes can be pretty frustrating because the probate courts are not typically dealing with children.
Yes.
And so I have certainly had the experience in some of the counties I've appeared in where it feels like they're elevating form over substance. You know, when you're dealing with estates and probate and all those things, you need very specific accountings, and there are a lot of rules that mm-hmm, have to be followed.
Mm-hmm.
And they get more caught up in those rules than actually stopping to look at, you know, here's a child who needs people to take care of them. And look, here are these wonderful people who've yeah. said, we'll do it.
Yes.
So let's help them out and not make it hard.
How often in a guardianship is it that the actual grandparents become the guardian of the child?
So I think it's very frequent informally, and certainly within the foster care system, they look for family first.
I see.
I don't know how often grandparents end up going through the formal process. It certainly happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to pretend to be the world's top expert on guardianships because, frankly, you know, I don't know any attorney who does more than a handful a year,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is one of the reasons I thought we should talk about them
yes.
more, because there are so many kids out there who could really use someone taking responsibility for them who may be falling through the cracks. And there's so many wonderful adults out there who actually are taking responsibility for children that aren't technically theirs and might be able to do a better job of it and be better protected in doing it.
When you say be better protected, what do you mean by that?
So I've had cases where, for example, I had a young woman who was a client of mine who had been raising a child that had been born to someone who'd been a close friend and had developed a serious substance abuse issue and basically left the child with my client. And my client fell in love with this child and really raised the child and was a mother to the child. But she lived with a constant fear that she had no legal authority to keep that child from the mother. So if the mother showed up at the door and said, give me my
child. I want my child, yeah.
Right. She would be in a position where she would potentially have to turn that child back over. And, you know, adoption is something we talk about under those circumstances, but sometimes either an adoption's too expensive or there are interfamilial or interpersonal reasons why they don't want to try to get the parental rights terminated. It's seen as a much more aggressive position to take when you're actually trying to terminate a parent's parental rights.
What control, if any, does a parent or parents have if there is going to be someone who feels he or she or they should become the guardian for a child who really needs this kind of care? What do the parents have to, a parent or parents have to say, okay, I agree, you become the guardian? Or is there something other than's going on, since obviously this goes before a judge in the probate court?
Right. And there is an investigation done by a probate investigator who will talk to the parents, grandparents, if they're involved, you know, sort of check out
the whole family situation. Or major family.
And make a recommendation to the court about whether this child would benefit from this guardianship. Honestly, so there absolutely can be contested guardianships. I am happy to say I think I've only been involved in maybe one. In my experience, parents who are struggling, who are not able in any particular moment to care for their children, often can be talked into cooperating with a guardianship to keep the child out of foster care and to prevent an adoption.
So there is a real advantage to having a child have a guardian appointed by the probate court as opposed to the child going into a foster care.
Well, I don't know if there really is or it's a perception, but yes, I would say yes. So the parent can nominate the guardian. They can set. They don't lose control to the same extent. Once a child goes into the foster care system, you know, the parents lose a lot of control. By definition, because if the child's in foster care, the parents have been found to be unfit.
And
I don't do dependency work, so I apologize in advance.
When you say you don't do dependency work, what do you mean by that?
I don't work within the foster care system.
Okay, all right.
So I'm saying anything wrong, I apologize in advance.
Well, I didn't hear you say anything wrong.
My understanding.
And then my ears were open. By the way, if you've joined us in the last few minutes, we're doing, interestingly enough, my guest Deborah Wald is a specialist in family law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. She is an advisor to the family law section of the state bar, has been involved with the family law section of the state bar for several years. And we're talking about guardianships for minor children. For those of you who are listening to the live program, in a few minutes I will give you our toll-free number and you can call us and ask a question, make a comment if you like. I just wanted to let you know what we're doing. And one of the things that I want to let you know about, if, for example, you are having a legal problem, there are a number of very informative free legal pamphlets available from the State Bar and also the Board of Legal Specialization. And if you want to try to educate yourself in a number of different areas of the law, these pamphlets are available to you from the State Bar as well as the Board of Legal Specialization. You can go to the website, www.calbar.ca.gov. That's www.calbar.ca.gov, and then search for pamphlets, both for the State Bar as well as the Board of Legal Specialization. I think you'll find they're very, very well worthwhile. What do you find as being the most difficult thing that you are confronted with frequently in a guardianship situation, if there are any?
You know, honestly, as an attorney in these situations, for me, the most frustrating part is just managing the paperwork involved, is sort of what I was saying before, because working with the probate court, most of us are in family court most of the time. We know how to get things done, and it's a very different world in probate court.
Lots and lots of paper.
Lots of paper, lots of rules, lots of very specific requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, you know, these are happy endings to challenging situations, and so it's an uplifting area of law. So I wanted to go back for
sure,
a minute.
Sure, please.
A couple of things. First of all, how does someone become a guardian?
Yes, please.
Not just that, not technically, but sort of how does it start? Every parent of a minor child should have nominated someone to be a guardian. There is a one-page form called a nomination of guardian that every parent should do. Many parents do their nominations of guardian within their wills, if they have a will.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's great, but it's not enough, because a will only goes into effect if you're dead, to be
sure.
Very blunt.
Of course.
If you're incapacitated, if you're in a car accident, particularly single parents,
mm-hmm.
but really every parent, I believe, should do a nomination of guardian. It's, as I said, it's a fairly simple form, and it is an official way to tell the court, if I can't take care of my child, this is who I want to take
Where
care of
Where is this
them.
Nomination of guardian form? Where
so,
do you find it?
I am guessing if you Google nomination of guardian California, you would find one.
So this is a form that the court has
The
set
court
up?
Does not know. They're not a judicial counsel form.
They are not.
But they're not. It would be nice if they were, but they're not. But I'm guessing maybe through the State Department of Social Services. I'm not sure. I'll get back to you on that.
What you have to do, the nomination of guardian form, is this something I nominate so-and-so. You date it. To be the guardian of my child, Jimmy,
in the case of
Jimmy
my death
Joe
or incapacity,
whatever.
Right.
And then you date and sign it, is that right?
Yeah, name, address, and phone number of the person you're nominating, and you date and sign it. And honestly, I mean, for my own kids who are now in their 20s, I think we changed the nominations 3 different times.
Because
really? The person who was perfect when they were infants.
Yeah.
Was not the same person who was perfect when they were in middle school. You know, people move, people
sure,
get married,
course,
people get
course.
Divorced.
What do you do with the form when you fill it out?
You just keep it with your other important forms.
I see.
And ideally, your guardian, the person you're nominating,
you might,
knows.
You might, hey, I won't let you know.
Right.
You're it.
And they should know where the form is. But the courts are actually, the probate courts
yes.
are obligated to take seriously, to seriously consider someone who's been nominated by the parent. So that is a very important thing for parents to do. And then the other piece that we were chatting about a little bit before we went on the air that people don't know about. So guardianships are typically either or. Either the parent has custody or the guardian has custody.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We don't typically do co-guardianships where a parent says, I still want to be a custodial parent, but I need help, and I'd like this person to be formally appointed by the court to share custody with
mm-hmm.
me. Because typically we don't appoint guardians for children unless they don't have a parent who can take care of them, which
mm-hmm.
is why I'm saying it's sort of the private equivalent of foster
mm-hmm.
care.
Mm-hmm.
There is an exception to that in our family code, in our probate code, where a parent has been diagnosed with a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
The sole custodial parent has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. And under those circumstances, upon proof, you have to get something from the physician confirming that the parent has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. The probate court will create a co-guardianship between the parent and the person that the parent is nominating to be the guardian, so they can share responsibility, and that transition as the parent gets more sick and ultimately passes away can be handled smoothly without a need for drama when the parent passes.
What if you have someone who unfortunately was in an accident and is perhaps mentally incapacitated for a while, maybe permanently or maybe temporarily? And my Martin McLean, Martin, you're really good, my friend. Martin just came in the studio here.
Is there a judicial counsel form? I love it. He just printed this out.
Yeah.
No. Well, yeah, I guess you could use it. So this is the form that we use. It has three purposes: consent of proposed guardian, nomination of guardian, or consent to appointment of guardian. This is the form that's used to nominate a guardian within a formal guardianship proceeding.
This is not what you've been talking about.
No, this is not the form that we use to nominate a guardian just sort of generally in case something should happen to me at some point in the future. This is a specific, now I'm nominating this person to be the guardian, you know, today.
Martin is constantly on the investigation
for any form that may apply. We'll see what else he comes up with. Martin McLean,
my assistant on this program. What if you have, however, someone who, let's say, is in an accident.
Yeah.
And perhaps is in ICU. And is incompetent for a while, and there's been no nomination of guardian, as we've been talking about, no nomination of guardian form. How does the court, the probate court, deal with this? Let's say you find out about it. Let's say some relative says, "Here's what the situation is, Deborah. What can you do to help us?" The child's mother, the sole parent, or father, sole parent, is has no capacity right now.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
So we would race off to court and file. We would file two things, presumably. So we would file for an emergency temporary guardianship.
I see.
And the emergency temporary guardianships, assuming we've done the paperwork right, are granted. So in that process, you clearly state what the need is. Why does the child need care? And they typically are granted with no investigation.
So you have
to give notice to all the right people.
Who are the right people?
So it's the parents, siblings, and grandparents.
Oh, really?
All get notice. So if someone's going to come forward and say, they're lying, that's not really what's happening, you know, they have a chance to do that. Mm-hmm. But assuming that is really what's happening, the temporary guardianships will be granted quite quickly, within a few weeks, maybe even shorter in a true emergency situation. And then in California, when you apply for a guardianship, you also have to apply for permanent guardianship.
I see.
Between the granting of the temporary guardianship and the hearing on the permanent guardianship is when this investigation happens. And the court does appoint a professional, you know, a social worker who works for the court, will do that investigation and then report to the court. So they'll then go out and actually check it out. They'll figure out what's happening. They'll meet the child. They'll see the home. You know, they'll make sure that everything looks right. And the court won't grant a permanent guardianship until that investigation is
Generally speaking, I know your practice is basically in the San Francisco Bay Area and Northern California. Apparently as far north as Sacramento and also Central California. What are we talking about? For a permanent guardianship, how long have you experienced it taking for the court to finally say, you are the guardian and here's the form?
So the time-consuming part is that investigation.
I see.
And honestly, it varies county to county depending on how quickly they can complete those investigations. So it can be that period of time from the granting of the temporary to the hearing on the permanent can be as short as a month.
Really?
Wow. It can be as long as maybe 3 months. It shouldn't be much longer than that because the court recognizes these are children who need someone responsible for
them.
That's
good to hear, considering how, for example, if someone has a civil lawsuit.
This is a pretty efficient process, months, if not years.
This is a pretty efficient process.
And they want to get that child. This is true in foster care. It's true in adoption. It's true. It's mm-hmm. a principle, a public policy principle that we want to create as much stability for children as possible.
Yes.
And that's why in California, we can't just go in for a temporary guardianship. They want a permanent guardianship in place. And then there's a process for terminating that guardianship if it's no longer needed.
The guardianship lasts until the majority of the child, age 18, is that right?
Or until it's terminated. So in the situation you describe, someone's been in a terrible car accident.
Yeah.
You know, the sole custodial parent has been in a terrible car accident. They're in the hospital. It appears they're going to be, you know, out of commission, unable to handle the responsibility to care for their child for, say, a minimum of 6 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You would go get that guardianship to make sure that someone else is able to do the things that need to be done. And if it's 6 months, you probably would have to get a permanent guardianship. But if that parent then recovers and there's no longer a need for guardianship,
then that's it.
Then they petition the court to terminate the guardianship and everyone, you know, says thank you and you're done. That is one of the places you end up in litigation, though, because sometimes someone's been a guardian for long enough and they've gotten attached to the child and then the parent wants to terminate.
This is interesting. We have come, by the way, to the end of the statewide version of the program. But for those of you who are listening to us live, we will continue, and I will give in just a couple of minutes the statewide version, actually toll-free number, for you. So stay with us on that, and I hope that those of you who are listening to us live will feel comfortable in calling in, and we can even talk about some other family law issues if you like. This is Your Legal Rights. I want to give you our toll-free number if you'd like to call in on guardianships or if you have other issues that you'd like to pose to my guest related to children, as her practice is exclusively for children. And I'm sure she has a lot of knowledge, but she does no divorces. Yippee!
Yeah, yippee.
I think, you know, in my practice, and I've been a lawyer for a long time, in my early practice, I handled a couple of family law divorce cases. I think that's the most difficult area of the law at all. And I've handled very serious economic crime cases and this kind of stuff. But that was my experience.
Yeah,
there.
Divorces are challenging. And as I said, my law firm does divorces. But I personally... You know,
congratulations.
Thank you. Most family law attorneys use family law as code for being divorce lawyers.
Also,
so I always have to say, that's not me.
No.
That's not what I do.
Here's our toll-free number, everybody. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and more recently Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services Program of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own, 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you are in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced in that area and set you up for a half an hour consultation, with minor exception. That half an hour consultation will cost you somewhere between $25 to $35. It's a great investment of your money for your education. And the money doesn't go to the lawyer. It goes to the lawyer referral service to support the service. Additional funding for your legal rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. So let's do this. Let me tell you who my guest is, in case you just tuned in. Deborah Wald is a specialist in family law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. She's an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her law firm is the Wald, W-A-L-D, law firm, or pardon me, Wald Law Group in San Francisco. So join us if you like at this point. With we're doing this program live on the evening of June 29th. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And Lisa, welcome to the program. Are you there,
thank
Lisa?
Thank you so much.
Hi.
Yes, thank you so much.
Sure.
Yes, I'm a parent who's been through a TPR, which is a termination of parental rights. And I had a child when I happened to be, you know, for the first time ever without a job and homeless. And I'd never taken services before, but I had to, I mean, I'd always been a working person, but I'd never been arrested, you know. I was a sensible person, professional. But, you know, I had to go through this and try to use the service as well. And I just want to let you know that, unfortunately, it's a shame because, you know, even Salesforce.com Foundation has donated a lot of money for housing for us. And there's a growing number of needy people, especially for legal representation, parents. And I have found out so much. I had lost my child, and I'm still trying to find a way because we are so desperate and underrepresented for legal experts and people who really will work for us. And it is a large and deep ocean of material. And I just wanted to say how much I appreciate that you're bringing this on the program tonight, because it's probably layers and layers deep of injustices. I have to say, I think that the information needs to get out more of what parents are going through, families are going, you know, through. And, you know, I'm so emotional. You know, I had to really compose myself because there's just so much to say about it. I've been all over the internet looking for clues and information and having to really work hard when I can get access, actually. You know, I had a donated secondhand computer I was using. You know, I mean, really, there are a lot of injustices for poor parents, and they don't really have a big enough voice. And I think that that needs to change. But I wanted to say thank you so much for bringing this on air, and I hope that you will continue to work on this particular area for people. We're having a lot of problems with corruption, and, you know, I hate to be negative, but I have to speak the truth just plainly. So we have been through some things with the process in court that seem extremely biased against the parents and the family, you know, as a whole. I believe that the parents and the children are equally the family. And this practice currently, the way it's set up, they tend to separate things in a different order that isn't what you would expect it should be like. Your roles change. There's sort of an agenda going on, you see, with, you know, it really is an agenda. I
mean, you, Lisa, you don't, at this point, you don't have a lawyer who's helping you, I presume.
I did, and I paid. I paid an exorbitant amount from. I had gathered some support, you know, from at least a few people. I've always been a working person, so, you know, I'm having to pay on this. But it's an enormous debt, and I'm currently homeless, and you know, looking for work again. But I even had to take a leave of absence, you know, so I could work on this.
Well, let me get some comments from my guest, Deborah. And I thank you, Lisa, for calling, and I wish you the best.
Yes, it did. Yes, thank you. The process in the court was, it didn't go well, and it was very, you know, 15-minute court, and it seems the adoption is pretty over-advertised and fueled compared to supporting family rights and reunification. And that also, I'd like for her, if she could go over the United Nations ratified laws that are now in the U.S. regarding this and UNESCO, as well as...
Let me get some comments.
I think
Lisa, thank you for calling. Let me get some comments from Deborah. So turn your radio back up if you would, Lisa. And again, those of you who would like to join us with, whether it's on guardianships or other areas of family law with respect to children, the toll-free number, 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Do you have some comments with regard to what Lisa...
Sure.
Her frustration, obviously, is incredible.
So, I mean, one of the challenges for the legal system and certainly for the family law system at this point is there's a huge gap between the level of poverty required to get public legal services through legal aid, for example, and what it actually costs to hire a private attorney. And so there are a huge number of people. They estimate at this point that 80% of family law litigants are self-represented. That is, they're appearing in court without counsel.
Yes.
Because they don't qualify. They're not poverty-stricken enough to qualify for legal services. Or in many counties, legal services only handle a very narrow slice of cases. Particularly, they tend to focus on domestic violence situations. But so they can't get free legal help and they can't afford private attorneys. So we're very aware of that. It is something the volunteer legal services programs that the county bars run are trying to address that. The courts, the family law facilitators.
Can you talk a little
offices.
Bit about the volunteer legal services programs that there the bars are doing? What are they?
They're a variety of, and again, I mean, I am just one person in one county, but the county bars are trying to find ways. For example, we put volunteer attorneys in the family courts to assist on they have self-represented litigant calendars where everyone's there without a lawyer, and then, you know, a bunch of lawyers will come and just donate our time for that day or that half a day or that, you know, that calendar.
To help someone who you've never met before, is that right?
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a wonderful project.
And most of the family courts are using volunteer attorneys for that purpose or as settlement, you know, to try to help people settle their disputes. So the lawyers are trying to help. I mean, and then the courts also have these family law facilitators offices. But again, they can only help a certain slice of things. So it's a huge challenge. I can't offer a great solution.
No.
The other thing I will say, though, is there's actually a federal mandate. One of the things Lisa was talking about you know, putting kids up for adoption instead of really focusing on reunification. There's a federal mandate to try to move children out of the foster care system within 18 months.
Oh, really?
And so if you have a parent who's incarcerated for longer than 18 months, or for whom it takes more than 18 months to stabilize, there's going to be a tendency within the foster care system to move that child into an adoption tract. And that can be problematic. That's very hard on parents. It's very hard on children sometimes if there actually is a solid, important bond between that child and that parent. It's not an abuse situation. It's that the parent, for example, incarcerated parents often still have very, very close relationships with their children. So again, if it can be arranged, if they have someone who'll take that child and take care of them, a guardianship can go on for 10 years. There's no requirement that you move from a guardianship to an adoption, although I had mentioned to you earlier that after 2 years of guardianship, the process, if people want to move into an adoption, becomes somewhat streamlined. But but there's no requirement. There's no one pushing to have that happen.
When you said there's a federal mandate that with respect to 18 months, what do you mean by mandate? Is it a law or what?
So now you're going to
call
me out on
I'm sorry.
Give you the verse and chapter, but what I'm telling you is true. I just can't tell you.
This is across the country, a federal mandate.
Yes, no, I'm sure that it is that funding. I am going to guess that funding sources are where they get the leverage, as is so often true. You know, when we all had to start wearing seatbelts and, you know, things like that usually are handled at the federal level by making funding contingent on compliance.
What would you say now, Lisa's obvious frustration and the great difficulty that she expressed to us, both what she said as well as you could hear it in her voice? What about the family law facilitator's office, which is something that is in every court in every county? How helpful can that be to people who need some direction? I know that family law facilitators' offices do not go into court to represent people. How helpful can they be in terms of trying to give them some direction, pointing them in the right direction, and maybe helping them with their paperwork?
So, again, I think there's a huge variance county to county.
I see. Okay.
In San Francisco, we have a self-help center.
I'm very well aware of that,
staffed by attorneys. That's where we would be, you know, suggesting someone like Lisa go.
Yeah.
But, again, the courts have been – funding to our courts have been cut year after year.
It's tough, yeah.
We're underfunded. The family law self-help centers have been cut. The staffing's been cut. Their hours are more limited than they used to be. There are less people available. And so, you know, I wish I had some wonderful solution to offer. I'm sorry to say I don't, other than, you know, it would be nice if everyone could let their legislators know that our family courts need to be funded.
Well, they know it. They know it. There's no way that any knowledgeable legislator would not know this. But nothing's happening.
It's not.
Unfortunately.
Yep.
Not enough, anyway. Here's a question that came in. In guardianship, is a child's prospective inheritance or right to inherit protected to an extent that would not apply in adoption?
Yes. Short answer to that question is yes. So again, the parental rights are terminated in an adoption, and with that termination of parental rights comes a termination of the right to inherit from the birth parents.
That's interesting.
With a guardianship, that is not true. There is no termination of parental rights, and so that lineage, that heritage, remains intact.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you the toll-free number again in case you have a question in the area of whether it's guardianships or some other aspect of family law issues involving children. It's 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What have we not touched upon, Deborah, that you would like to talk about in the remaining few minutes that we have?
So I did. You had actually asked me earlier if a lot of grandparents are guardians.
And yes,
I wasn't thinking when you did, and I actually want to go back and retract my answer.
Please.
Or at least clarify it. Yes, the answer is yes. Lots of grandparents are serving as legal guardians, and as I started to mention to you, unfortunately, in my experience, that can be, and not just with grandparents, but I was starting to tell you right before the break, that can be one place where things can turn into litigation because, you know, guardians who do take over the parenting responsibility and are raising children can get very attached to those children.
Yes.
And if the parent does rehabilitate or come back and want to resume their own parenting rights, unfortunately, there can end up being a pretty significant power struggle, and things can get contentious. And honestly, from my perspective, it's one of the places where, you know, I would so encourage people to go into family counseling, to go into mediation, you know, to try to work it out, because, of course, the kids are completely caught in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it actually is a situation. I know in Sacramento, they will grant co-guardianships under those circumstances, even though they're not exactly authorized in the family code. But, you know, I have seen, and other counties may do it as well, you know, probate judges who've been following a family for some period of time and understand that this child is still loyal to their parents, loves their parents. It's a good thing for the child if the parent's now able to come back and be more involved, but that they also want, you know, don't want to cut off the relationship that's developed over years potentially
course.
That guardian.
Of course.
So,
of course.
You know, it's... It's. I told you earlier that, you know, the custody is either or. Either the guardian or the parent has custody. And unfortunately, that either or dynamic can create a lot of tension. And so I think it's always worth people to step back and see if there's a both and solution available.
If there is a problem that has developed, there's a tension, there's a... let's take the grandparent. Grandparents have... taken care of this child for a few years, the parent says, I want my child back, and the grandparents feel, well, wait a minute, we've been taking care of this child for a while. You mentioned mediation. Where would one go for mediation? Directly to the court, asking the court, either the probate court or the family court, to help us in mediation, or what would you suggest?
So it depends to some extent on economics, but the court will typically, the court does have, the family courts have mediators, the probate courts, certainly in some counties, can access those mediators and try to
assist.
Is
there a charge for that?
Not if it's done through the court system.
I
so
see.
That's the benefit of that.
Yeah,
you know, for people who can afford it, there also are, you know, very good
sort of
family systems,
of
therapists
course.
Who can help a family like that work things through.
Yeah. All right, Carol, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, awesome, yes. Two quick questions. Why is the process attached to probate court, number one? And number two, what about in a situation where there has been granted a guardianship, what about further issues with possible inheritance in the person from the, or between the person who has been granted to be the guardian?
Okay.
So let me answer this.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Don't
go away, Carol.
First.
Stay, Carol.
So there will be no automatic right to inherit from the guardian, but the guardian, if they want to include the child in their will, is always welcome to do that.
Oh,
so that would be what if the guardian wants to share their estate with the child, they would need to do that through a testamentary document, through a will.
Yeah.
Or a trust or something along those lines. It will not be automatic the way it would be with a parent.
Okay.
And why is it in the probate court? I can't tell you I have the definitive answer. But again, my understanding is because estates and trusts and conservatorships, the guardianship process got lumped in with those things. And actually, there's an aspect. So I've been talking about what is referred to as a guardianship of the person. There also can be a guardian of the property. So and those aren't necessarily the same person. So you have situations where you want, you know, someone can't take care of a child, and the person who's perfect to take care of that child is not a good person to be managing money for that child.
Mm.
So you might have, I've seen this many times, you know, there's an uncle who's really good with money, who'll be appointed guardian of the property of the child to administer the child's funds for them and make sure things are paid for and that the child's...
Again, by the probate court.
By the probate court. So that's much more in common with the things probate courts usually do.
I see.
The mismatch sometimes is with the guardian of the person part, which I wish was in family court, but it's not.
Good question, Carol.
Thank you.
It was my question also to Deborah. Off
sure.
the air, yeah. Take care. Thank you very much for calling. All right, again, toll free, 866-798-8255. Anything else that occurs to you at this point before I ask you another question?
No, go ahead.
No, all right. You have, and this is something that you might want to talk about briefly, you have become involved with assisted reproductive law.
I have.
Tell us a little bit about this. This is a lot different than guardianship.
Right, we're going somewhere very different now.
Yeah.
So assisted reproduction law is, I guess it kind of comes in two flavors. There's people who are heterosexual couples experiencing infertility who need medical assistance to conceive, whether that is in the form of medication or in the form of an in vitro fertilization or whatever it is. I would be less likely to be involved in that because you've got a husband, a wife, and a doctor, and they're doing what they're doing. But what we call third-party assisted reproduction is when within the couple, gay, straight, or otherwise, they need outside assistance to become parents, whether they need eggs or they need sperm or they need a womb
Mm-hmm. So there's a third party involved, third person involved.
Exactly.
How did you get involved with this?
Initially I got involved in it, raising children in San Francisco and being very connected with the LGBT community here because lesbian couples and gay couples are not, they don't have all the right stuff within that relationship.
Right,
and so
there
are people who need to look to third-party assisted reproduction if they want to have their own children as opposed to adopting children. I was doing adoptions, but honestly, assisted reproduction is on the rise, and adoptions, there are way less adoptions happening around the country.
This is very interesting.
And
adoptions can become much more complicated, can't they?
Then third-party assisted reproduction can become complicated too.
Yeah.
But the reason that for people who can afford choices, mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that third-party assisted reproduction is appealing is because you do have more control because you can meet people and interview mm-hmm. them and figure mm-hmm. out if they're actually who you want to be doing this with in mm-hmm. advance. Mm-hmm. There are contracts in place. Mm-hmm. The relationships are very clearly delineated. Mm-hmm. Adoption tends to be, by definition, somewhat more chaotic. Given that...
And much more expensive, is it not?
No.
No,
Assisted reproduction, it tends to be more expensive. You know what? That's not even necessarily true because there's, people who want to have babies figure out how to do it.
Of course.
And there may be no doctors and no lawyers involved.
Yeah. Hopefully no lawyers.
So with third-party assisted reproduction, actually, hopefully there are lawyers involved because there are more people involved in creating that child than actually intend to be parents of that child,
so
typically.
So you've got to clarify who's who.
Right. So it actually is extremely useful to have clear written agreements in place as to mm-hmm. who's doing what and why and who's going to be responsible for that child and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Or there can be really huge, expensive, incredibly emotionally draining messes.
Maybe you can come back at some other time and we'll use
we'll
that
at
the focus of the program.
Law. There you go.
We've got Kathy from Pacifica. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are
you
doing,
for
Kathy?
Me. What?
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm doing good. I just have a question here for the guest.
Go ahead.
On guardianship.
Yes.
I have a 10-year-old grandson in Canada who I'd like to take guardianship of or adopt. He was born there. He's a Canadian citizen. So I don't know, what my rights are. Can I do that can I take guardianship from down here, or do I have to do that up there?
So that is first going to be a question for an immigration lawyer because you are going to need to figure out how you get your grandson into the United States legally and without committing fraud. Because, if your grandson comes to visit on a tourist visa just to come hang out with grandma, well, of course, from Canada, they don't need visas. But mm-hmm. if they enter... in a tourist status, temporary status, and overstay, that may be a problem. I know just enough immigration law to be dangerous. So my advice to you would be to start by talking to an immigration person. In cases where there is an international component, 100% of the time, I work collaboratively with an immigration attorney because that's such a complicated area of law. I'm very specialized, and I don't want to make mistakes because with immigration law, if you make a mistake, it can have really devastating consequences.
Someone could be put
they
out of
be
the
deported.
Country.
They could be deported. Prevented from ever legally immigrating. So.
Kathy, do you have a pencil or a pen?
Yeah, I have a pencil. But I was thinking of trying to take guardianship of him up there because my son, the problem here is that his mother died and his father is in jail right now.
Okay, so that is a child who needs a guardian.
Where is the child? So, where is the child, Kathy? Very quickly, we're getting
foster
close.
Foster care right now.
Okay. Where? Where though? Where, dear?
In Canada?
Langley, BC, British Columbia.
In British Columbia. So let me tell you something. For a child who one parent has died, and the other parent is in jail. If that child can, and again, I'm not giving immigration advice. Let me say that three times over. You need to check with someone. But if that child, in fact, got here, there is something called special immigrant juvenile status.
Oh, really?
And special immigrant juvenile status is a way to get legal status for children, juveniles, in the United States who do not have a parent who's able to take care of them.
Kathy, I want to have you write down. Kathy, I can't have you make any more comments because we're nearly out of time. Okay. I want you to write something down.
Okay, will do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The Bar Association of San Mateo has a lawyer referral service. I'm going to give you the phone number. Call them and see if they can set up for you a half an hour consultation. You live in Pacifica, which is part of San Mateo County. Here's the number, 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. Start by calling the Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service. Tell them that you would like to meet with an immigration attorney. You have some question about whether or not you might be able to become a guardian for your grandson who's a Canadian citizen, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what you should do. I'm sorry we can't take more comments from you, but we're running out of time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Please call them tomorrow or when you can during normal business hours. I think you'll find them very friendly to deal with.
Can I give one more suggestion?
One more. Go ahead.
The National Center for Youth Law in San Francisco or Legal Services for Children also might be able to give you advice.
Say that again. Which is it?
National Center for Youth Law or Legal Services for Children, both nonprofits based in San Francisco.
Yeah. Good luck to you, Kathy.
Okay. Thank you.
I think you can do it if you keep working on it. You want to do it, so keep working on it, and I think you'll be able to do it. So good luck. I hope you end up where you do have the guardianship of your grandson. So what we're going to do now is ending comments from you. We've got half a minute, my dear.
Half a minute. Okay. So I guess I'll end where I started, which is that I wanted to have the opportunity to talk about guardianships because there are so many kids out there who need people to take care of them and so many wonderful people, adults willing to take care of children. And this is just one more tool that not enough people know about to provide stability and security for those children and the people who care for them.
Deborah, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's been great having you back on the program. Deborah Wald is a specialist in family law certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her law firm is the Wald Law Group in San Francisco. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Chuck.
Your legal rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. This segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar. By the way, next time on Your Legal Rights, we're going to be talking about laws protecting persons who are disabled. My guest will be James Shea, a certified specialist in federal Social Security disability law, and Scott Ford, a certified specialist in workers' compensation law. We're going to talk about the benefits under those laws for people with disabilities. Additional funding of this program is provided by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks for joining us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio, and I hope you join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney. We'll be right back.